Written in the wake of modern mankind's worst violent cataclysm to date, the Great War, Lothrop Stoddard's The Rising Tide of Color noted the sharp decline of European civilization and the breaking of its dominance over the colored world it had held since the advent of colonialism in the 15th century. Stoddard went on to predict the further deterioration of the white world's relative standing in the years to come, as the rise of Asia and the utter annihilation wrought upon Europe in the Second World War paved the way for final decolonization and the rise of a new world order that saw white supremacy and even race-aware thinking such as Stoddard's deemed anathema.
Well, I'm not a crook. I've burned everything I've got.
Military-industrial complex.
A new world order.
But we are here to destroy the control over the industry of other people.
I did not trade arms for hostage.
It's been time-stealing.
Мільце пав документів 7-чіві подкаст.
Hello, welcome to the program. I am Nick, and I am joined by Hank, Hans, and Adam. Hello.
Full house.
Hey, guys.
Hi, guys. Hopefully my audio issues have been fixed. I apologize for the last episode.
I'm sure it'll be. I'm not sure of anything, but we'll make it work. So I think today what we're going to do is get into a little bit of, good old-fashioned race hate. And I think we've had some people wonder whether or not we're going to talk about the race problem. So we're going to talk a little bit about the race problem today. And in the context of that, we'd like to do a little discussion about our man Goddard.
Well, let me thank a couple of donations before we jump in. There were two since the last time I thanked anyone for this from Bitcoin. The first one was the wallet starting with the characters 1FSI, if I'm reading that right. The second one is from the wallet starting with characters 17ZC. So thank you to both of you guys. And if anyone in general has donated on Bitcoin, please just email myth20c@tutanota.com. If they would like a copy of Exit Strategy, I'd be happy to send that to you. And if you haven't received a copy and you've donated in other ways and there's any issues, you can also email there and I'll figure it out. Okay, so Nick, please proceed. Back to you.
Well, I think that there's an important tradition of race thinking in America that I don't think gets a lot of attention, mainly because it's something that I've, of course, treated as, some of these guys who are writing in the early 20th century that they're seen now as, I guess, cranks or, lunatic KKK people or something. And, I mean, in reality, I mean, someone like Stoddard was immensely popular in his day and age. And well translated in several different languages, well known on the speaking circuit, so to speak.
Apparently, popular journalist. I don't know what status. I guess it was a press pass, but he got access to some of the high command in Germany during the war, or prior to the war between Germany and the United States, at least. But during Germany's war, he actually wrote a book about that, Into Darkness. It's quite good, actually. A very interesting perspective on wartime.
Yeah, his
Germany was like.
He interviews Goebbels and Himmler.
Right.
It's very interesting, actually. That's kind of the explanation, the mainstream explanation that you're going to see for why he kind of fell out of favor. I made the Gatsby allusion earlier, which you'll probably see whenever you really read into him, because that's sort of the one place he's still in kind of popular consciousness, because that's a book that, the children do read still, I think. And so the context of that has to be explained. But they'll say that the reason that he's out of fashion as Madison Grant is that his association with National Socialist Germany. One of the main reasons, and that's actually something that we can discuss here, it's just the reason why he kind of got swept under the proverbial ash bin of history. And I mean, there's the obvious reasons. Of course, the fashionable Jewish sociologists really started to have their ascension around the time that he died. So, you know, this is not something that anyone wanted anybody looking at. And there was no real obvious successor to someone like Stoddard, no one who was allowed to become as popular and who was as well read and making very simple points, many of which were very prophetic. I mean, most of what he predicted has come to pass. I mean, we were living in the world that he saw coming in, you know, the early 1920s.
Yeah, I noticed that as well. I mean, 100 years, I hesitate to call it like a genius insight because, you know, I consider us fairly normal people, despite what the media might want to portray some of us as. But, you know, he was writing this 100 years ago, and obviously no access to the internet, no YouTube, no whatnot to get easy information at the click of a button. But he was amongst some of the elite intellectuals of his time. He was a professor at Harvard, at least he had gone to Harvard, one of the two.
He had a PhD in history from Harvard.
Right. Okay. So clearly, and especially at that time, that was truly exceptional because there were very few people going to college, let alone to Harvard back then. And so that was, I think, rightly a mark of a superior intellect. And some of his work is actually focused on the eugenics of actually intellectuals in society and sort of the problems inherent in mass democracy and giving power to people who basically just click for more Gibbs, essentially, and then it degenerates the whole of society. But he was talking about this long before a lot of us in this thing have been talking about it. And so he deserves a lot of credit for that, I believe. And I did pick up on that, like you, Nick, that he was somewhat prescient in predicting where our sort of society would go. But one of the things also that I was thinking about was maybe it was one of the questions I had was, why was he talking about this? Because he was basically highlighting the transformation of, I think, Europe essentially after the First World War. It was basically the war that broke colonialism, I think. The empires of Europe were basically so strained and broken after that war, and that the decolonization movements obviously picked up heavily after the Second World War, but I think Gandhi was doing his thing after the First World War. And so that may have been what he was noticing. And what he predicted, though, was in terms of the racial makeup of the world population, at the time, 100 years ago, believe it or not, one-third of the world was actually of European descent. And he was noticing that was starting to ebb. It was going to decline, and he was right about that. Today, I think the European population as a percentage of the entire world population is probably around 10%, maybe a little bit more, but it's a substantial decrease from where it was. And so it really was kind of the pinnacle and then the beginning of the decline, and he predicted that fairly correctly, which was impressive.
Well, so there's a couple things to add there. So he's mostly thought of just as some eugenicist, right? And that really wasn't, I mean, he was a historian, and he was really a geopolitical theorist before anything else. I mean, he was looking at the world situation, and he was looking at the world situation very similar to someone like Oswald Spengler was looking at the world situation. He was seeing in the war the great suicide of Western civilization and the consequences of, for example, of what white rule had brought in its own undoing to the rest of the world, the you know, proverbial Pandora's box of technology and the extent to which the masses, the colored masses, were becoming becoming politically aware. And that's another observation. I'll actually read a few things that he has to write about this, because he described, for example, the first European war. He drew the analogy to the Peloponnesian War. And so he writes, and Europe is the white homeland, the heart of the white world. It is Europe that has suffered practically all the losses of Armageddon, which may be considered the white civil war. The colored world remains virtually unscathed. Here is the truth of the matter. The white world today stands at the crossroads of life and death. It stands where the Greek world stood at the close of the Peloponnesian War. A fever has racked the white frame and undermined its constitution. The unsound therapeutics of its diplomatic practitioners retard convalescence and endanger real recovery. Worst of all, the instinct of race solidarity has been partially atrophied. Grave is the situation and is not yet irreparable, any more than Greece's condition was hopeless after Agostomene. It's not the Peloponnesian War which sealed Hellas' doom, but the cycle of political anarchy and moral chaos which the Peloponnesian War was merely the opening phase. Our world is too vigorous for even the Great War of itself to prove a mortal wound. The white world thus still has a choice, but it must be a positive choice. Decisions, firm decisions must be made. Constructive measures, drastic measures must be taken. Above all, time presses and drift is fatal. The tide ebbs. The swimmer must put forth strong strokes to reach the shore, else swift oblivion in the dark ocean.
I think it's interesting that when he's talking in the context of post-World War One, it's not just post-World War One. You saw kind of the first inklings of this when the Japanese soundly beat what was more or less a European power, Russia, in 1905 or 1904, I guess. And I don't actually think he's that incorrect in kind of attributing the rising tide of color, so to speak, at least some of it, to the double immolation of Europe in World War One, of course, and then again after he was sort of his more popular initial or foundational works in World War Two. That seems to have been like a defined trend, and not just kind of like in the macro level, but it seemed as though there was a conscious effort on parts of the broader Anglosphere, notably the United States, to kind of assist in that effort, to actually use these internecine conflicts to have kind of this more equitable, I don't know what would be period appropriate phrasing of this, but you know, a flatter Thomas Friedman-esque world where naturally these ex-colonies will become independent and ascend to proper nationhood, and the Congo will become Belgium or whatever.
Yeah, what is interesting, I mean, he also makes another point that is very, very similar to what Spengler would say, which is the use of colored auxiliaries, colored mercenaries in that European war was politically fatal for exactly these same reasons, because it awakened in them a political consciousness and also showed to them the weakness of the white man's world, the extent to which, you know, there was blood in the water, basically. And by putting rifles in their hands and using them against other European powers was a breaking in the implicit white solidarity that had existed prior to the war. I mean, you had little colonial scuffles here and there and, you know, typical, you know, ancient rivalries, but it wasn't anything on the scale of the annihilation that took place there.
How new and how significant was that? Because if you go back to the revolutionary times in the United, well, not the United States, the colonies of England and France, the conflicts between the French and English was fought oftentimes with a lot of Indian mercenaries, Native American mercenaries, whatever you want to call them, the tribes. They were given rifles.
Well, he would call them the red man.
Right. Right. And so they were doing that 400 years ago. And I don't know to what degree that was making up the percentages of the armies that were fighting each other. In World War One, my impression was that the colonial recruits, mercenaries, whatever they're called, from India, for example, fighting on the British side were fairly insignificant. But I could be totally wrong about that. I don't know what the numbers are.
The French used the coloreds and the occupation of German lands,
right?
And they did that on purpose. And this was something that inflamed tension.
Yeah, that's more of a political move. But in terms of just the military numbers,
That they're being used in a political struggle like that. I mean, sure, there's nothing entirely novel about foreign mercenaries being used, but the extent to which they were being used and deployed on European soil was definitely a new development.
Okay. Yeah. Well, to Hank's comment about, I think you were saying America would sort of join the side of the anti-colonialists, and of course the long-standing antipathy between the United States and England, and by extension, the colonial powers of Europe, sort of makes that make some sense. And then the implicit motivation there is that America would then sort of take over, or the system of America would take over, seems to have come true. And then,
well, that's one thing he did not foresee was he did not understand that American power would be used, the extent to which American power would come to be used against the old colonial empires.
You're right. He didn't
mention that. That was one thing that he did miss.
He did because mention
he was
Japan
much of a man
lot.
Of his class and time. He was an American through and through, which gave certain strengths as far as his ability to look past some of the petty rivalries that were taking place in Europe and be able to see them in the context of the world race situation. Mm-hmm. And I think that him being an American helped him be able to do that. However, at the same time, I don't think he quite understood what American power was about to be used for.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think too many people did. He did mention, last thing I'll say about some of his writings on kind of the predictions, and some of this obviously came true, and it was taking hold at the time, but it had not fully manifested itself. Japan was obviously the rising power in Asia, and so he was making a lot of comparisons between the different races. Obviously, the Africans and Europeans are quite different, and he's talking about the Arabs sort of being a blending or a transitionary area between Africa and the rest of the world. And then he was highlighting how Japan had sort of taken the lead of Asia, but he'd predicted, again, somewhat correctly, that the population numbers of Japan compared to the other mainland powers like China just could not sustain that. But he mentioned also that the Japanese were also taking full advantage, in addition to the Americans to a degree, of the fact that the European colonial powers were breaking apart after the war, and Japan was trying to fill that void. And they were using similar rhetoric to almost what you could envision either maybe a communist or a free worlder in the Cold War using to kind of grab the attention of the Third World. And basically Japan was saying, you know, we will take on the responsible mantle of they try to tiptoe around the fact that they're going to effectively be the leader, but what they're offering is an escape from the quote-unquote oppressiveness of the European. And what Stoddard says, though, is that the Asian is actually much more brutal in nature than the European. And that was also proven out quite a bit over the next 30 or so years, especially during the war in Japanese occupied areas. The Japanese occupation of Manchuria and Korea were particularly brutal. And then also the prisoners of the Japanese were treated quite harshly as well. And so he was right in pointing that out.
Yeah, you don't even need to look forward. You can look back to China basically killing off a third of their population every 100 years in these massive, massive peasant rebellions, or rebellions of various stripes, dynastic conflicts. Like, most of their deaths have been internal in nature, and they're just astounding. And the Tang Rebellion, it was like coincident with the U.S. Civil War. So it was within living memory for people who would have been alive at Stoddard's time. And that was like tens of millions of deaths.
Yeah, he also saw that the race character that Asiatic Bolshevism would take on, because he saw that it would end up appealing to the various colored peoples, and use that as a wedge against the white world, which is, again, exactly what happened.
What was his motivation in all this, do you think, Nick? I mean, was he just concerned for the culture and the people dying? Did he have some sort of grand worldview of what things should be?
He saw a civilizational crisis, dude. He saw the end of Western civilization.
Sort of like Spengler.
Yeah. I mean, he saw that this was basically it. Like, if the problems that were unleashed in the early 20th century were not properly dealt with, then yeah, we would be wiped out. And it would be the yellow man and the brown man. That's one of the interesting things. When you talk about Stoddard in an American context, where you see like system publications write about him, you see that typical American obsession with the Negro. I mean, Americans are just, they're fucking obsessed with the Negro. He was basically his view of this was like the Negro is more or less unimportant, and it's the real issue is the Asiatic world. And the brown word. He was also a scholar of Islam. And he says at one point, I don't have the exact quote on hand.
Oh, the numbers that he cites for the population of the Arab world is unbelievable. If you know how much it's exploded since then. But he was talking about like tens of millions of people in the Arab world. We're talking about billions now. I mean, it's getting insane how much they've replicated, to use a crude term. But talk about a rising tide. I mean, that part of the world is incredibly multiplicative.
Yeah, he was a scholar of Islam, and so he, that was another thing that he was way ahead of the curve on understanding, which is the rise of pan-Islamic fanaticism. And he says I did find the relevant quote. So he says he's talking about the military threat of the colored. So in the case of like actually bringing arms to bear, and he's summarizing that such. He says the colored peril of arms may be thus summarized. The brown and yellow races possess great military potentialities. These, barring the actions of certain ill-understood emotional stimuli, are unlikely to flame out in spontaneous fanaticism. But on the other hand, they are very likely to be mobilized for political reasons like revolt against white dominion or for social reasons like overpopulation. The black race offers no real danger except as a tool of pan-Islamism. As for the red men of the Americas, they are of merely local significance.
Yeah,
that sums it up.
Pretty much. I mean, the plight of the American Indian has basically they've vanished. I mean, they're probably even less of a factor now than they were back then. Even though the majority of the Indian wars had been resolved for decades at that point when he was writing this.
Well, I believe he would probably be referring also to the Indians of Latin America.
Yeah, he does highlight them as being basically the bulk of where any of their sort of advancement is going to come from, because the sort of Plains Indians, the Northern Indians, have really just disappeared, and they never really had much history of any true, in terms of like city building, they never had civilization in that sense. And so he does look to some of the developments of Central Americans, especially in the past, as sort of their cultural heritage, but he doesn't see much evidence of that today, interestingly enough. And so the theories that he gets into of like the evolution of the different races is quite interesting to me, because obviously genetics had not really been developed in the 20s. That was more of a 1950s thing. And so his predictions about, you know, where kind of the different races had evolved from are, you know, more or less, you know, in the ballpark, especially, you know, given sort of a grading on the curve sort of thing for a guy who doesn't have access to the information that we do. But there were some I think things that were wrong. I mean, I think and this is still debated today for obvious reasons. But the people in India, for example, that he cited, there is a huge difference between just the physical appearances of the northern and southern Indians. The southern being much more dark skinned, which you could ascribe to obviously the climate and the sun exposure levels. But he basically traces their sort of development to having a lot of African blood and some of the genetic tracing that has been done, you know, after he's done his writing and access to that science being even developed, has shown that may not actually be accurate. It was sort of a co-development in the different regions. But nonetheless, more or less, you know, I think fairly in the ballpark, if you're kind of a fan of Cochrane's writings, he'd probably be someone that Cochrane could have some respect for.
Yeah, I think back also to the point about people focus again on the Negro, especially Americans. I'm not exactly sure what the reason for the American obsession with the Negro is.
Well, they're here.
I have a few things I could.
I mean, that's not only are they here, but if you look at kind of the people of the intellectual caste in the 1920s, like there was kind of a Southern intellectual tradition, and it's not just that they're here. It's like that was a primary problem of Southern intellectual thinking. And it doesn't suffice to say like, well, they're not relevant because like we could simply kill them all. Like that's not going to be a good idea. That doesn't comport with the fact that the U.S. is a liberal society. Like that would be insane and absurd. So the question is, how do you actually live along with these people, given that they have approximately as much, you know, claim to be American in whatever sense you're going to construct American to mean, as anybody else on the continent. How do you live with them despite the very clear and obvious differences and, you know, the manifest failure of a lot of past experiments in how exactly to manage that relationship? So, I mean, it's like, it's a question. It's not something that Stoddard deals with in depth. Like, that's not his thing. And it's probably something that kind of, you know, lacks global world historical significance. But I mean, it's a thing.
Oh, it is a thing. It's just that's exactly my point, is that when he's talking about the world situation and, you know, projecting out into the future, looking at the race question generally, it's the first, what is American critics or Jewish critics in particular, what they're going to say is like, oh, well, it's you hate the Negro and you think the Negro is inferior. And I guess this leads us into the famous
debate. It's also, they're used as an avatar because it's so clear that they are so incredibly distinct. Like, I think if you look at, you know, even if you get quantitative, you don't need to, but you can, and you look at things like, you know, genomic or ancestral differences, you'd have to go to Australia and, you know, look at Aborigines before you found somebody who is clearly more distinct than that. Like, you know, high caste Indians, they can get along, like Chinese people, you know, the Hapa is like a meme, but it serves as a very useful rhetorical device to have them around to point at as kind of the avatar of otherness, to point out how much these dastardly racists hate the other, which is a very paradoxical thing to do, of course, especially when they're not exactly very good at sort of seizing the initiative rhetorically and claiming to advocate on their own behalf. They're much more useful as that sort of a prop if you have a mind towards dominating one segment of the population rhetorically.
Yeah, and that brings us to his debate with W.E.B. Du Bois, which was kind of a cartoonish affair as far as you can tell. I've had trouble finding the exact transcripts of it, but so I don't have anything too juicy to read. We can put up, if you're watching the slideshow, the advertising poster for it, which is pretty funny, actually. It presents the question as whether it is the Negro should be encouraged to seek cultural equality with the white man. As well as, I guess,
like, bro, question. You can seek whatever you want. Like, go for it. Push the envelope.
But should he be encouraged? And that is embedded with so much power and implies so much about what America really is and how it regards the black race. To me, as if I was a black person, I would find that insulting. I would not want someone to encourage me to behave like what they expect me to behave. I would want to do whatever I thought was appropriate for me.
It's nice white lady mindset.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it's like, exactly. Oh, you need a nice white lady to, you know, really encourage you to explore your artistic ambitions. Maybe make a rap song. That's what you guys like to do, right?
Do you think that we could say that a lot of this is really being debated right before a couple decades before the civil rights movement, because no one really knew what to do with blacks after the Civil War.
There,
I think that
the civil rights movement succeeded was just the last in a string of, you know, also things that could also be qualified as civil rights movements. There was a ton of black activism going from, I mean, especially in kind of this this time period post World War One, but I mean, it was not exactly like the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s did not propose some kind of radical new accommodation or arrangement so much as it proposed just the destruction of existing ones. So, I mean, I think the
point I was trying to make was that, is this really just, I mean, Lothrop's daughter was essentially a WASP, right, from New England?
Oh, yeah.
Or just from the northeast of the country?
I think he was like Dutch or something. I'm not sure what the name. He says it in one of his books. I just forget. But it was somewhere around there.
Okay. But he's in with these WASP circles. He's spending a lot of his time in northeast. He dies in D.C. or the D.C. yeah. area, I think. Right. And this seems to me like a lot of his view was probably very widely held at the time. It's very poignant to us now, but it was probably a widely held view, or at least part of the dialogue, like considered serious part of the dialogue of, you know, what exactly do we do with this element in our society? I mean, Nick, you're saying that basically, you know, the basic theory you take from this is that America is obsessed with the Negro. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that, you know, a huge chunk of American history has, even up to this point, was centered around this question of what do we even do with these people? Like, they became such an integral part of the political dialogue that kind of filtered down into other elements of life in America, that it was always inevitable, I think, that it was going to come down to this, because no other country had this long-standing, sustained slave population that they had freed and were now sort of trying to participate and were causing problems. No one really knew what to do with this, so there were no great historical examples to work from. And I think that was where the obsession stemmed, really, from basically that no one knew where to look. And Lothrop's daughter was trying to, I think, formulate this new theory of basic, you know, very basic fundamental racialism, which is that they're just not like us. And they really shouldn't be here, or if they are here, they should not be part of our own in-group society. They should be doing their own thing.
Yeah, he talks a lot about nature versus nurture, and he ascribes most of it to hereditary traits.
What you would call, I believe you would say, the biracialist position at the time, which is basically separate but equal is the idea as far as it goes. Like, that was one of the things that they were debating. Jim Crow, in his debate with Du Bois, Jim Crow's brought up, and the Jewish publications that are writing about that in retrospect say that, you know, it's like the room erupted with laughter when he said, well, you do have, like, the goal is to ensure that you have, you know, facilities that are for your own, and, you know, it's equal.
I mean,
which I guess there is kind of funny in retrospect, but
there are examples in history of doing that, where you do create these kind of bifurcated societies. I mean, whenever France was not actively purging religious, I guess, minorities from the country, particularly Jews, Protestants, Huguenots, whatever, they did this thing where they would essentially establish separate institutions, separate facilities, separate areas just for those people, just to kind of, you know, keep their own population from getting too wild and maybe killing them all, and trying to keep everyone kind of separated so that there were no longstanding issues and that they didn't impact the larger functioning of the country. They had their own institutions. And ironically, you can also look at Quebec in Canada. I think, honestly, that if you asked Lothrop's daughter, you know, if you were alive today and you showed him basically the arrangement that the Quebecois have with the Canadian government, and you said, maybe, you know, would something like this, with maybe even slightly more autonomy, satisfy your constraints here? And I think he would say, yeah. They have their own area where they speak their own language. They have their own laws. They have their own charters. They have their own everything. I mean, I think that he was not like a racial supremacist or a eugenicist as much as he was just trying to solve this long-standing implacable problem in America. What do you do with the blacks in America? Because this is not going to end pretty. And everyone could kind of tell it was not going to end well, but no one really knew what to do other than, I guess, people like Sanger, who he was associated with, who wanted to euthanize the population, slowly euthanize them. And then there on the other side, there were people who wanted to slowly integrate them, but wanted to kind of placate the separationists,
the segregationists, and allow for this sort of dual system where they get to vote, they get to participate in the wider society, but they got to like live in their own area. They got to go to their own schools. I think that Stoddard like just wanted them to have their own land, and just they run that and we run everything else.
Well, it's the question of supremacy is interesting because the book, I've been quoting for at length, his most famous book, The Rising Tide of Color, the full title of it is The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy. And the thing about that is white world supremacy was just a fact. I mean, to a certain right. extent, I guess it still is a fact. I mean, it much less so, but I mean, the existing civilization of the time, to the extent it still exists now, was European civilization. And the extent to which, you know, you had coloreds participating in the expanses of that in the colonies, or they themselves, the rapid industrialization of Asia was a result of white world supremacy. I mean, it's political, territorial, and technological supremacy. I mean, it was just a fact.
It's more like white man's burden than I think like pro-slavery. He saw it more as, well, we kind of run the planet.
Well, he wasn't a Southerner.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, that, and that's what's even more curious, is that he's basically taking a sort of pseudo-Southerner position, but he's not advocating. I don't think he ever really advocated a return to slavery, or, you know.
Not only did he not advocate a return to slavery, and when you're talking about as far as how to manage living with a lower population in your midst, or trying to rule over them. I mean, he was just acutely aware of this problem. This was his first book, which I think grew out of his thesis from Harvard, was his The Revolution in San Domingo, where it's about what happened when the Haitian mulattoes rose up and slaughtered all the Frenchmen. And he saw the mulattoes there as the great danger too, because the mulattoes were the ones who had enough, you know, ability to agitate the, you know, full blown Negroes into you know, committing a mass slaughter. So he was well aware of this problem. And as far as the rest of it goes, as far as solutions, I could read, it's in his sort of conclusion in The Rising Tide, he has this in his reflections, basically, this is in the 20s, as to what should be done with the world situation. This is what he has to say. He says, first and foremost, the wretched Versailles business will have to be thoroughly revised. As it stands, dragon's teeth have been sown over both Europe and Asia, and unless they be plucked up, they will presently grow a crop of cataclysms which will seal the white world's doom. Secondly, some sort of provisional understanding must be arrived at between the white world and the Renaissance Asia. We whites will have to abandon our tacit assumption of permanent domination over Asia, while Asiatics will have to forego their dreams of migration to white lands and penetration of Africa and Latin America. Unless some such understanding is arrived at, the world will drift into a gigantic race war, and genuine race war means war to the knife. Such a hideous catastrophe should be abhorrent to both sides. Nevertheless, Asia should be given clearly to understand that we cannot permit either migration to white lands or penetration of the non-Asiatic tropics, and that for these matters we prefer a fight to the finish rather than yield to a finish, because our finish is precisely what surrender on these points would mean. And thirdly, even within the white world, migrations of lower human types, like those which have worked such havoc in the United States, must be rigorously curtailed. Such migrations upset standards, sterilize better stocks, increase lower types, and compromise national futures more than war. Get on earlier, which is another very pressing observation, which he saw in the future sort of world struggle. He saw Asia penetrating into Africa and Latin America, which today is exactly what we see.
Well, you know what that reminds me of? Of all people, we need to do a show on him specifically, but that reminds me of Henry Kissinger. In the sort of early 2000s, he went through a phase where he was writing heavily and actually doing a lot of travel and speaking, promoting the idea that essentially the U.S. and China should come up with some sort of a understanding whereby they would basically split up the world between them to avoid the traditional conflicts that arise between a rising power and an existing hegemon. And he duplicates a lot of the sort of prescription in that regard. I don't know how much.
I would not be shocked if Kissinger is at least familiar with Stoddard.
He definitely would be.
I mean, if you have to look at the time, he was basically in school. You know, I think he basically came back from World War II and immediately became sort of like a. I remember reading his biography.
He was an officer of the occupation of Germany. Right. That's what his job was.
And he was a keen reader of this kind of stuff before the war. He was always into politics and books on economics and so on. And he immediately went back to studying after he got back from the war, and I think in 1946. And so I wouldn't be shocked if he. We know that he's read some very kind of risque or obscure writers in his time. He's probably read just about everything when it comes to politics. So what you're saying that he's basically taking the Stoddard thesis, it's more than likely true that he just read Stoddard's books, or he was at least someone talked to him who had read them, and it was part of some discussion he was in his kind of formative years.
That's totally possible.
You know,
during his time when he was kind of running around the world as Nixon's Secretary of State, he made some like very casual statements where he basically kind of proclaimed that there was this, and several Russian premier or Soviet premier said the similar thing, where there was this sort of sameness between the Soviets and the Americans, and it basically just boiled down to like, well. There's a common like European white element here, and we should probably, you know, endeavor to work together because we can at least understand each other a little bit more than perhaps other powers can. You know, we can understand other powers like India or China.
The ironic thing about Kissinger, though, is that he was on the tip of the spear, to use the cliche, of opening up relations between China and the United States, and obviously that was because of the height of tensions of the Cold War, trying to break up the Sino-Soviet alliance.
Well, a lot of that had to do more at the time with Vietnam and how Vietnam was imploding, and Nixon and Kissinger basically wanted a way out. Mm. And originally they thought that the best way out was to get the Chinese to help out and kind of transition.
That's true.
That ended up not happening.
For the domestic audience, yes. It was also to help with the war, but it was also for the grander strategy of the Cold War, which, you know, in the short run, it made a lot of sense. And I do give him some credit for pointing this out in the early 2000s. But, I mean, at this point, I mean, the rise of China has been such a problem for the entire Western world. I do not give him a lot of respect for doing what he did back then.
The distinction is between like a cooperative divvying up process versus some attempt at containment or subversion, right. Or to actually try to prevent that rise by force. That's the two kind of intellectual strains on the right with regard to China.
Well, and so Stoddard's position on this would have been that he would like to have seen, or basically a strategic retreat from Asia, that by continuing to, you know, engaging imperialism and colonialism in Asia, you're just adding more resentment and tension that will lead to the Asiatics coming into white controlled lands. So he would say, you know, our race duty is therefore clear.
The British and the French did.
Yeah.
I mean, the French, when things got really bad in Vietnam at the end of the 50s and early 60s, the French just left. Like, they didn't even want to fight really hard for it. There was an opportunity where they could have. I think that if they had committed 200,000 troops and they just didn't care what anyone had to say and they kind of, you know, just brutally killed everyone in North Vietnam, they could have held on to it, but they basically decided it wasn't worth it. And it was better to just kind of pull out, and they saw Britain pulling out of India and pulling out of a lot of other parts of Indochina, and, you know, kind of leaving behind their positions in China. And, you know, I think that everyone in the 60s was basically under the impression that this game is over and it's time to just kind of to move on.
I think
also, around the same time you saw like the French basically working in behind the scenes to leave Algeria, and everyone was sort of trying to find ways
That should have been held. And that's exactly the point. Like Algeria should have been held. North Africa should have been held. And Stoddard would agree insofar as he would say probably he would take a position actually somewhat similar to the fascists like Mosley. And he would say that the exterior areas of the white world should be concerned about that aren't the immediate white homelands would be North Africa and Latin America. Those should be the two areas of focus. And basically let the Asiatics have Asia.
Well, that was a question I had, and I'm not familiar with this, but did Stoddard ever even write about Latin America?
Yeah.
Yeah, was
that
ever talking
like
about
prescient
that.
in his writings?
Yep. Yeah, he, that was one place, for example, one thing he would say about Latin America was that it's kind of the exception that proves the rule as far as the one of the few places where you had more recent white expansion into more
places
or less,
like Uruguay, which are majority.
Which
European.
Are, by the way, Uruguay apparently is very, very white.
Oh yeah, look at their soccer team. Yeah, I mean,
so are parts of like Argentina and Chile are really, really white. So, I mean, I think another question I would have is, did Stoddard predict the Asiatics getting into Latin America? Because that's basically the other side of the world that China has
talks about
attempted
Japan
to infiltrate.
A lot. Japanese
yes, he
were
did.
Seeing
the, That's he absolutely predicted that. That was another thing that was very much ahead of his time.
Like most of his predictions are in terms of population migration, not so much the neo-colonial, neoliberal economic colonialism, which we've seen much more of, I think, in our time, whereby you don't necessarily have to move your population to control a country. You basically just control the banking system and you control the free trade and foreign policy regarding economics, and you have access to your multinationals that way. We're seeing a lot of that going on everywhere. And how do you account for that? In his terms, I don't think you do. I think he's thinking in terms of more of like people where they live, and that's how he does it.
I have an appropriate quote for this too. So also rising tide. But the matter does not end here. There, sorry. The matter does not end there. The white world also cannot permit with safety to itself wholesale Asiatic penetration of non-Asiatic colored regions like Black Africa and tropical Latin America. To permit Asiatic colonization and ultimate control of these vast territories with their incalculable resources would be to overturn in favor of Asia the political, the economic, and eventually the racial balance of power in the world. At the present, the white man controls these regions, and he must stand fast. No other course is possible. Neither Black Africa nor mongrel-ruled tropical America can stand alone. If the white man goes, the Asiatic comes, browns to Africa, yellows to Latin America, and there is no reason under heaven why we whites should deliberately present Asia with the richest regions of the tropics and to our own impoverishment and probable undoing. This is not like 1920. I mean, like this man really does not get the credit he deserves.
So how, let's talk about that. How was his perception, reception in the United States, his home country?
Best-selling author.
But how did the cathedral or the synagogue, as you'd like to put it, regard him?
Proto-Zog.
That's kind of
where I'm
getting at. It's like the establishment.
Well,
Harvard,
all the Jew papers. He was him. Okay. So he was published by Scribner's, which might have also had something to do with the fact that he did not really have a lot to say about the Jews. However, there have been people, you know, the Jews themselves will dig out things that he said privately. I remember that one of Hearst's papers attacked him, and he apparently had said to someone in reference to that, that Hearst's paper was just a Jew rag. And of course, the immigration acts that he, in the 20s, that he was part and parcel of getting passed were, you know, hostile to Jewish immigration. So he definitely was not not making friends with the Jews, and they were not taking too kindly to him. That being said, Scribner's, I mean, presumably was a Jewish publishing house.
And you mentioned this debate between W.E.B. Du Bois and him. How did that go?
Well, one thing I should say about that, too, that's also kind of funny, just in the context of what we're talking about with Asia, is that W.P. Webb Du Bois He was like proto. I mean, for people, I'm sure people probably, if you went to any system academies, you would have probably been proselytized about the great W.E.B. Du Bois. But it was like the proto MLK. I mean, he was the one who was appealing to the sensibilities of the white liberals to, you know, basically just like turn over white institutions to Negroes because reasons, you know. But W.E.B. Du Bois, he actually met with Mao in like the late 50s before he ended up going to Africa. I think that's where he died. But yeah, it's kind of funny. You can put in a slide, you can put the picture of him with Mao. The debate, it went pretty poorly. I mean, it wasn't really a debate. It was more like a circus act, really, because it was something that W.E.B. Du Bois constructed. I mean, he set it up. And so it was basically in front of an entirely Negro audience.
Oh, geez. Well, you know, it's funny, too, because the debate that Buckley did with Baldwin at Harvard, I believe, was sort of the opposite of that. And all the whites sided with Baldwin. And so this is, you know, smash cut to the 60s, not the 20s or wherever, whenever they were doing this. 1929, I'm seeing this, when the debate between W.E. Du Bois and Stoddard took place. By the 60s, I mean, the white people had basically been inculcated with this self-hatred so much that they voted for the black Baldwin over the white Buckley debate.
Yeah, I mean, he mentions, I think, the book, what is it, Souls of Colored Folk or whatever it is, the W.E.B. book. He had presumably read it. There's not really much for two men like that to talk about when all is said and done. I mean, he would have had a lot more to talk about with Booker T. Washington, who I think shared a lot of common opinions as him. And, you know, Washington and Du Bois were basically rivals for Negro support in general. I mean, in somewhat analogous sense to MLK and Malcolm X.
Nick, I do have a question about, I guess you would call it, The Revolt Against Civilization. I don't know if you're familiar with that book or not.
Yep. That's the book that introduced the term Untermensch.
Ah, yes. So this is part of this popular mythology that the real Nazis in the 30s and 40s were actually America, because America inspired Hitler. I don't know if you guys have seen.
Yes. Oh, I've seen that. Yeah, that's like the racist contagion. I mean, it goes back to, like, you know, America's original sin of slavery was so virulent that it actually crossed the Atlantic.
Hitler did not like Nazis.
Not just that. Like, they come up with this entire complex that National Socialism was influenced by Andrew Jackson. And like in Manifest Destiny, or something.
Which, like, okay, so there was clearly some Prague influence, but it kind of, you know, went both ways.
Yeah. There's a clear lineage though from France to England to America and back to Germany as far as certain racial theories. This is true.
Yes, I mean, it's true, but this is like kind of a weird tangent. I'm sorry, folks. This is like one of the common things you hear about Lothrop Stoddard, if you hear anything anymore. Like, every now and then some Jewish writer for like the Daily Forward or whatever will write an article reminding you that this man existed. And he'll be like, this American, you know, or this guy, he coined the term Untermensch, which of course we know that was a Nazi word. And I think that's all he's ever remembered for in like common.
Yeah, they'll call him a proto-Nazi, and the National Review crowd is going to write about him too. I found some Kevin Williamson piece where they're doing the typical thing. Well, like, oh, here's the true racist legacy of progressivism. You know, arch progressive Margaret Sanger and her association with Lothrop Stoddard, and therefore Negroes are the real Americans, I guess.
So, I mean, did he use the conventional? I have not actually read that work, but did he use it in the same sense that, progenitors of the actual myth of the 20th century would have understood the term?
Yes, more or less. I'm sure I have a quote here somewhere. It's how does the underman look at civilization? The civilization offers him few benefits and fewer hope, but usually affords him little beyond a meager subsistence. It's just people who have been brought into the scope, the ambit of the civilization, who have nothing to offer and only to take. Is the context in which he means it. And the internal, I guess, racial decay leading to a collapse of civilization would be not just the color, it's just generally inferior people who should probably be sterilized would be his position.
Well, let me ask you.
Does Stoddard really kind of pinpoint a specific culprit or a set of forces, or is he just sort of pointing out how things are developing? Is he just sort of studying and relaying information about the phenomena?
I mean, it's similar ideas that you would find in other sort of not necessarily progressive, but right-wing thinkers. I mean, it's just the process by which civilization leads to abundance and which leads to degeneracy, which leads to decay and collapse.
So it's more like Evola than
National Socialism. Evola mixed with. Yeah, mixed with, well, national. That's the thing about National Socialism, though. National Socialism is itself kind of a hybrid between certain idealistic racial doctrines and certain very materialist racial doctrines. So, you know, before I had read Stoddard, I had assumed he was just kind of a very materialist-minded sort of racialist. But he actually has a lot to say about sort of the spiritual dimension of race consciousness and of the nation. It's not entirely a biological process for him. There's a lot more to it than that. I mean, for example, too, when he talks about what it is that the First World War did to European civilization, it wasn't just, you know, the immense waste of resources and waste of life, but it was also setting in motion a sort of a spiritual decay. Is kind of how he would look at it. He probably had read people like Brooks Adams, you know. I mean, that's something that would have been belonging to his time and education for sure. I actually could safely guarantee you he's read Brooks Adams, so it's probably coming some influences like that.
I'm just trying to understand what is the meaning of all this. I mean, I'm not trying to downplay it at all, but it goes without saying that these ideas have not been adopted by the powers that be. And you have to ask why. I mean, the system that we live under has really nothing to do with, outside of Asia perhaps, really nothing to do with a racial doctrine on a national level or international level is probably what he would argue for. Mm-hmm. And that just has not caught on. So I'm asking the question, why is that?
Oh, it was more popular then than it is today, at least amongst the people who mattered.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
I mean, the Immigration Act of 1924 was something in vogue at the time. Also, the Cooley exclusion.
And that was basically the product of Madison Grant. I mean, Madison Grant and others basically made that happen. And that was something I was curious about was, you know, how deep was the relationship between Stoddard and Grant? If there really was one.
That is a little complicated. So Grant wrote the introduction to The Rising Tide of Color, but they definitely had slightly different ways of looking at this. I think that that's a subject in of itself. I guess we could do one on Madison Grant and kind of compare and contrast from that. I don't know on the personal level how close the relationship is, but I mean, he certainly makes a lot of use of Grant's writing in The Rising Tide.
Yeah, because Grant really wasn't pinpointing culprits as much as he was just sort of laying out how bad it is and why it's bad, rather than kind of focusing on like, well, you know, here's who's doing this to you and here's their motivation. It was more of like, you know, this is kind of where we stand and this is where things will be in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, so on. Yeah, it was like, you know, they both seem to be more focused on just sort of like, they're both very I would call them academics almost, in that they're just sort of very focused on describing the phenomena and trying to understand how it'll play out, rather than like always looking at the root causes or culprits behind the root causes.
I don't even think it's 100% accurate to describe Stoddard as, for example, a racial theorist. That's not exact. Right. That you could absolutely say of Grant. But for Stoddard, he's just dealing with the facts on the table. I mean, he's not even necessarily a hardcore racial determinist either. Because his whole point is the race question will play out in the context of the general world political situation. I mean, it's the questions about colonialism, imperialism, the aftermath of the war, the relationships between European powers and this kind of thing. And that while this is all being hashed out, waiting outside the door is, the coming of the rise of the colored peoples. I mean, don't get me wrong. He was an unironic Nordicist. that is true. But that was, common to his time. That's probably also why he was pretty well received in the Third Reich.
Did he kind of ran in a lot of these circles. We covered this in our eugenics episode, where there was this clear bond between, I think, early 20th century progressivism, as it was, which was really just, I think you would more likely just call it industrialism. Scientific industrialism was really what it was at its core at the time. And he kind of ran in some of those circles, and he was particularly enmeshed, if you want to use the word, in certain eugenicist societies. But as we kind of pointed out in that episode, a lot of these eugenicist societies, A, received incredible funding and scholarship work from very respected people, like Nobel Prize winners in various fields were part of these organizations. And B, they kind of tried to infuse scientific industrial politics and bettering man and fixing the problems with man, but also trying to alleviate certain things that were currently hurting man. There were, in particular, some of the eugenic societies were focused on how to deal with industrial pollution, because they had discovered around this time it was actually altering people's genes. It was having a real genetic impact on people to deal with large amounts of industrial pollution and so on in the early 20th century. So was his interest in these societies and in these fields just more academic and much more focused on the science and the history rather than just, oh, I hate black people kind of thing?
Yeah, I don't even think it's fair to say that he hated the Negro.
Right. And I think that's how he would be cast. I think that's how he's cast now. I think, honestly, if you just look at his Wikipedia page, it's basically just
incredibly brief.
Right.
It's basically right. He was born there. He did some stuff. Undermensch, Web Dubois. And don't forget, he wanted to exterminate all the non-right white races of the world, which is,
Can you even see the old edits on Wikipedia to see if this is cut? I mean, they didn't hide that.
If you're browsing Wikipedia on anything remotely interesting or controversial, don't even read the page. Just read the talk page. And see what has the most controversy behind it.
I mean, I was trying to get to this, and you guys didn't have too much to say, but what I really want to understand is, why does this worldview not have any place in our society?
Okay, so there's the straw man that as soon as you start talking about differences between people, this is the classic Prague projection. As soon as you start talking about differences between people, ipso facto, by noticing the difference, you are a exterminationist. And I mean, Stoddard is just he's replete with that. Like, his central kind of motivating metaphysic is that there exist these different groups of people in these different places, and they have these forces working upon them, and therefore they do this stuff and they get into conflict, and it could come out this way or this other way. And that's you know, obviously a more realistic, like more intellectually honest way to approach it than whatever, I forget which tack we're on here, that like we're all the same except for white people are uniquely evil somehow. I think that's what we're going with now. But I mean, if you have even the sort of rhetorical allowance for attempted objectivity, then that's very dangerous and not politically useful, because you can no longer use these rhetorical cudgels to prevent people from asking certain questions or just like making objectively true statements that aren't handy for you.
Yeah, this is okay. So if you were to look at what, you know, the mulatto was saying back then and you carry that through to the day, not much has changed. They've been doing the same thing, and it's just they keep doing it. What changed was the American right. I mean, the fact that he's getting the similar kind of hit pieces from like the National Review that he would be from, you know, I don't know, insert, you know, the New Yorker or whatever, something like that. So you get this. They haven't changed their script, but the right has totally capitulated. And so, I mean, the main difference, I mean, he was just looking at the world, what everyone already understood this stuff. I mean, they understood he was to looking at race similar to maybe someone like Mackinder was looking at land masses or something like this, right? He was just looking at the facts of the world political situation and understanding how this is potentially going to play out, and it's going to play out to the detriment of the white world. I mean, this was now to even point out that there is such a thing as a white world, as white civilization, that is, you know, this is forbidden thinking to begin with. You're supposed to have some bizarre conception that has no basis in reality.
If you really wanted to do it, you could pull the whole, you know, essentially the same maneuver that's done with the white replacement theory, that it's not happening, it's a conspiracy theory, also it's a great thing and you deserve it. Like, it would be very easy to recast a lot of Stoddard's analysis, not necessarily his prescriptions, obviously. But you could do like a light rewrite and stick it in the Atlantic with a wow, isn't this great caveat. And, you know, nobody would bat an eye.
Mm-hmm. Would it be fair to say that this way of thinking has been effectively made illegal, especially after the Second World War, by the power structure? I mean, that to me is the simplest way to put it. You know, the association with Nazi Germany was not inaccurate, and given that that has been deemed the worst possible thing you could be in our modern civilization, the type of person that would be holding court with the chief propagandist of that regime probably is not going to be held up as a pinnacle of something that we should all strive for. Now, I'm not saying this is a value judgment. This is just sort of a statement of observation of our current society, and I would explain it that way.
And not even that he was associated with you know, this with Germany per se, but, you know, there had been a ideology that had completely replaced, like, the Western states had a new ruling ideology as of 1946, 48 or so. Like, this idea of communism light, in the sort of guise of, you know, what would later turn into neoliberalism. That's avatars of old ideologies were actively purged with kind of you know, direct proportionality to how much they were in opposition to that ideology, not so much how much they were associated with like racial thinking or whatever. But I mean, Robert Taft got purged all the same. You know, that sort of is an overlapping.
Yeah. It's much like how the end of the Civil War basically led to Reconstruction, which was effectively, we're going to northernize the South under the Northerners' supremacy. And that's what happened after the Second World War. It was basically the Allies imposing their ideology upon the masses. And
but far more so. I mean, you know, after the Civil War, it wasn't 20 years, but that, you know, the South sort of regained its political freedom. And, you know, as of the time that Stoddard was writing in the 20s, I mean, that's when a lot of these Confederate monuments were going up.
Like, that's right. Well, because the KKK was basically forcing the Washington's hand and basically saying, hey, look, you know, you need to stop the discrimination against us. This occupation of yours is not what we want. And that was the concession that they gave them.
And it was like in like a lot of the 20s, the 50-year anniversary of the Civil War, there were huge numbers of celebrations, which is like an odd thing to do for a civil war, but huge amounts of celebrations that were basically like, oh, isn't it great that the North and the South are all friends now? And they had like very elderly veterans of the U.S. Civil War shaking hands. There's even some early video footage of it. But it was sort of a, you know, united as white men to secure the continent type thinking, which was much more in line with Stoddard's thinking. But that, you know, that ideological strain of Manifest Destiny that predated the Civil War also postdated it. Like the U.S. Civil War, weirdly enough, it did not lead to a substantial kind of ideological transformation of what America was for, quote unquote. I mean, it was obviously a rejiggering of governmental arrangements and certain elements of the power structure. Yeah. I mean, I mean, that's at the point at which you can have people flying Confederate flags in the 20s talking about, like, isn't it great that, like, we're all brothers now? I don't see that as having the same level of ideological switchover as, you know, you look at something like the, you know, you can't have a third between 1935 and 55.
Of course, you can't have a Third Reich, you know, flag flying in your front lawn today versus the Confederate flag. But the war did change the United States. I mean, no question about it. I mean, the question of slavery was put to bed. I mean, the whole W.E.B. de Blois debate would not even happened in half the country until that war was fought. So,
right, but in terms of like ideological, like the ideological purpose of the United States government, I mean, there was an attempt, you know, the radical Republicans to presage the later transformation that, you know, in the same way that the USSR rules in the name of the workers and peasants. Like, there was an attempt to say the United States federal government, like, operates to advance the interests of the Negro, as they would have put it at the time. But, I mean, that was defunct almost immediately. Like, within, what, when did Reconstruction end? Like, 10 years after the end of the war? So, I mean, that it was sort of an abortive attempt by some factions to kind of switch horses. But I mean, World War II is the foundational myth of the current world order worldwide.
Right.
Even in places like China, you know, if you want to bring it back to kind of the to that actual discussion, like their founding myth of their state is Mao Zedong, the Long March, fighting the Japanese, the establishment of the People's Republic of China, which is all sort of in that same milieu. Like, World War II was just such a drastic ideological reconfiguration that somebody like Stoddard, who is operating into the old paradigm, you know, it's like, it wasn't wrong per se, but it had a not even wrong. Like, he wasn't addressing that sort of thinking was not capable at that time to, like, intellectually engage with the post-World War II liberal state.
Mm-hmm. The last thing it says in the Wikipedia entry is, after World War II, Stoddard's theories were deemed too closely aligned with those of the Nazis, and so he suffered a large drop in popularity. Yeah,
the deemers deemed them.
Yeah, his death from cancer in 1950 went almost unreported, despite his previously broad readership and influence. So, citation needed. This is from Matthew Pratt and Guteri, The Color of Race in America, from Harvard Press.
Yeah, what color is race?
Rainbows.
Yeah, I wonder. I never read anything that he wrote after 1945, but, I mean, so much of that. I mean, sure, that the post-war liberal order, I mean, basically put the nail in that kind of thinking, you know, because he was coming, Stoddard's thinking is coming from class and coming from, you know, the elite. I mean, it now the only people are, you know, crackpots on the internet, like talking about like long dead American racialists. So I don't know. I mean, I guess I could close, as Celine said about what happened there. It's, what was it? The fall of Stalingrad is the finish of Europe. There was a cataclysm. The core of it all was Stalingrad. There you can say it was finished and well finished, the white civilization.
Walking down Main Street, getting to know the concrete, looking for a purpose from a neon sign. I would meet you anywhere, western sun meets the air. We'll hit the road, never looking behind. Can you deny there's nothing greater, nothing more than the traveling hands of time? St. Genevieve.